the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
I hate to have to ask them to turn down Dave Brubeck, but I think the time has come. If you're not in a session about migrants, refugees, internally displaced, and mobile populations, and their risk to HIV/AIDS, you're in the wrong room, but you're welcome anyway. My name is Lori Garrett, and I'm with the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and I welcome you here this afternoon. For more than 20 years, we have in the HIV/AIDS world, and actually, in a larger sense, in many of the emerging diseases studies, been arguing about just exactly how much such issues as internal displacement, refugees, and so on, contribute to the risk of transmission of HIV in any given population group. There has been an assumption made in many quarters that war is in itself a risk factor for HIV/AIDS, that being internally displaced, from uprooted from your home is a risk factor, that refugee status is a risk, that migrant populations are at special risk. But the truth is, all these claims have been almost universally without data to support them. Not necessarily meaning they're not true, but that the data has not been there. No rigor has been applied. We recently at the Council on Foreign Relations tried to examine exactly what does the data support and not support, and produced this report for the Security Council of the United Nations on HIV and national security. Where are the links? This is, by the way, available at the Council on Foreign Relations website, www.cfr.org. That's my advertisement. But we should have data. We should have empirical evidence if what we choose to do is guide policy. And hopefully today you're going to hear such evidence more than anecdotes from the panelists here with us. I have a couple of requests of the panel speakers. The first is, please remember, we have a very broad audience here, which is a great thing, but that means that the acronyms often used by people who deal with refugees and so on, such as IDP, have no significance and meaning. You must define your language, please. I would also request of the audience, put your cell phones and pagers on vibrate. And before we plunge into the data, I don't want to completely say that anecdotes are without importance. In fact, they set a framework that helps guide the analysis and the science in these areas. And one of the most important stories you could imagine hearing in this area will come from Noe Sesisaba, my co-chair, who works for the NGO Stop Sida Nkubura Uwemva. Did I pronounce that right? I probably massacred it. Yeah. Noe was born in Burundi, but in 1996 was forced into exile in Tanzania, and in 2001 learned that he was HIV positive. Noe.
I am going to try to speak in English, but you are going to excuse me because my first language is not English, but French. As she said, I am a Burundian from, I am Burundian, and I used to be a refugee since 1996 in the western of Tanzania. What I have to tell you is that I have an experience of war, of displacement of life in camps, and also I enroll also in my life the HIV status. I am HIV positive. What I must tell you is that the situation of war or the situation of displacement of the situation in refugee, the life in refugee camps and the after life of being in refugee camps, it is a life which brings high vulnerability to HIV contamination. I say this because within the war, there are practices or barbarities which expose people on HIV contamination. And during the displacement from the war area and the camp, there is a distance which is also at a high risk of contamination. And life in a refugee camp is a life with poverty, also we don't have access to facilities, health facilities, economical facilities, social facilities, and you can understand the situation. And after repatriation, the main problem is that you are not known in your country of origin because you have spent many time outside. And the main situation is that refugees are in between situation, which means that you are not considerate by your country of origin, and you are not considered by the host country. And in that situation, also NGO who are dealing with the refugees hesitate. Their plans are especially on emergency issues, and you can appreciate the situation. As she said, my organization, Stop SIDA, is a community-based organization started in order to see how the community itself should bring a bridge in that situation. And we have tried to raise awareness in refugee camps, and now because now my country is in peace, I repatriated, and we are trying to link refugees to the opportunities within my country. What I recommend in conclusion, because I would like to give the occasion to the experts who can explain more about this, is that it is good to encourage regional initiative which can consider refugees and which can plan according to policies of the country of origin and also the country of the host country. That's what I can say, and that's what we are trying to do with the Stop SIDA. I think I don't have to say anything about that. I can stop here, hoping that the experts here will talk more about that. Thank you.
For logistic reasons, we're going to have to make a small switch in the schedule. The speakers don't know this. Paul Farmer will come before, one notch before in the prior order. He needs to leave us early. But first we're going to have Dr. Paul Spiegel, who is with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees and has worked with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's on the faculty of, get this list, Tulane, Emory, and Johns Hopkins, is an epidemiologist and has been searching for empirical links between HIV risk and refugee and war status.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the organizers for helping to organize this.
And in particular, thank you to Noe, who I've known for many years and spent the last week with, and you're quite an inspiration, Noe. I will speak. There will be my overview. Laurie has told me I must stick to the time frame, and she's quite strict, so I will not be going reading all of my slides. I want to start by mentioning what the definition is that we use with complex emergencies, conflict and force displacement. The top definition is with the Interagency Standing Committee, and the bottom definition is what we often use at Centers for Disease Control. You can have a quick read of them. I think the main issue, and where I believe the top one is probably better, is that at CDC we like to measure things, and so we talk about increases in mortality, often a doubling of the baseline. However, there are numerous instances, Lebanon being another one quite right now, where the mortality was not extremely high, but it was obviously a complex humanitarian emergency with a lot of displacement. Refugees and IDPs, internally displaced persons. The big difference is that refugees have crossed an internationally recognized border. There is a 1951 Refugee Convention clearly stating their rights and protections. IDPs, internally displaced persons, have not crossed the border and lack these internationally recognized rights, and it makes it much more difficult to access these population and provide sufficient services. Throughout the short talk, I may use the word DPs or displaced persons, which will refer to both. This is really what we're talking about here, is the conflict. Who are the people? We have conflict-affected populations that don't move, people in Srebrenica. Refugees that cross the border, and there you can see the border. Perhaps I have. No, I don't have a pointer. Refugees that move across the border, and then you have the surrounding host community who are constantly interacting with these refugees. You similarly have the internally displaced persons and their interactions with the host community. So there are numerous populations we are talking about, and not just refugees, which in many ways are the easiest populations to deal with. Here are some brief numbers. Refugees. There are approximately 13.4 million. The number of refugees have reduced dramatically over the years, which is a good thing, primarily due to large-scale repatriations to Angola and to Afghanistan, and inshallah, southern Sudan soon. So we have 9.2 million from UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, and another 4.2 million, which are Palestinian refugees under a different organization. IDPs is much more of a guess, and we have less exact figures, approximately 25 million. 50% of these people are under 18 years. We have tried also to talk about the hundreds of million likely affected by conflict but are not currently displaced, and those are very hard to count. And I will not discuss the disaster-affected populations, such as the droughts and such as the tsunami that we know of recently, which are also very, very important populations. Okay. I will skip this other than say the key players are, of course, the displaced persons themselves and the surrounding populations. One group for us in the field that is not so new but is becoming more and more important are the military, and very controversially, because as you know, humanitarian aid should be very neutral, and in many places, and in particular Iraq and Afghanistan, you have military actually starting to not just work on logistics but actually supplying services in the populations, and this can cause great confusion as well as great danger to the NGOs and other working in the field that are attempting to respect neutrality. Okay, we'll talk some of the epidemiology, but this is most of my research, but it is not the main purpose of my talk today. What I would like to show here is, this is from Nancy Mock at Tulane and others. In the brown here, countries that have been at war for longer periods of time. Here she has measured them in the number of people killed. You do have an inverse relationship between the HIV prevalence and many of these countries. This does not mean, I repeat, does not mean it is not causal. It does not mean war is protective and HIV prevalence is automatically low. But there does appear to be a link. We did some simple analysis at UNHCR looking at where refugees come from and where they are going to. And in general, in both Africa and Asia, refugees are moving from a lower prevalence, thus moving from conflict areas, which often have a lower prevalence, to a higher prevalence.
This does not mean, as an old head of the Africa Bureau said at UNHCR, this is good news, we now don't have to address HIV amongst refugees because the prevalence is low. Not at all. Obviously, the refugees are often surrounded by populations that have a higher HIV prevalence. However, I'm going to skip this, but we have now in over 10 countries numerous HIV prevalence and HIV prevalence data amongst refugees and surrounding populations. And this is pictorial to show you what the refugees have compared to surrounding populations here. Sometimes it is the same, sometimes it is lower. What I want to end on the epidemiology part is to say that most of the literature, both peer-reviewed and the media, concentrate on the increased risk here. What no one really was looking at for a while is what is the area of origin from where they come, where are they going to? No one has looked at the level of interaction between the displaced persons and the refugee and the surrounding populations, and in particular, few people have looked at what is happening in conflict when there is no mobility, when there are no reduced mobility, fewer truckers going through the country, less urbanization, and often with urbanization comes men searching work, sleeping with commercial sex workers, and then going back to rural areas and infecting their wives and other partners. So we need to look at this, and we need to decide on each individual case separately, examining some of these factors, and I'm sure there are others that I have missed. I want to go over three documents that I think are quite important for complex emergencies and displacement. Number one is the Sphere Project, which is an attempt to, has a humanitarian charter as well as universal minimum standards as well as indicators and core areas from nutrition and food security, health, coordination, etc. This is very important, and in the revised version, HIV is in there as a cross-cutting issue. The second one is the Interagency Standing Committee Guidelines on HIV/AIDS and Emergencies. This was an attempt by experts to say this is what needs to be done in 10 sectors. This is what minimally needs to be done in the emergency phase and how we need to scale up in the post-emergency phase. And then finally, for this section, post-emergency, UNAIDS and HCR has put together three major lessons learned, and I'm going to go through these very briefly. Number one is integration into both host country strategic plans and proposals to the Global Fund. This is just a simple analysis showing in Africa, in 2004, there were 29 countries with greater than or equal to 10,000 refugees. Out of those, we examined 23 plans. 15 of them mentioned refugees. They said they're vulnerable groups like ID, drug users, commercial sex workers, men having sex with men, and left it at that. Only 10, 43%, actually provided activities for refugees, thought of them in their strategic plans. If we're going to fight this epidemic, we need to include all marginalized groups. And host countries have to consider, it's also part of the 51 Convention, must consider refugees as part of these populations, as IDPs must be considered. We've done similar analyses with the Global Fund, approved proposals, and the MAP proposals, and they both are showing a lack of inclusion of refugees. And what's happening is this is leading UNHCR and the other UN agencies, as well as NGOs, to develop parallel programs for these groups, which is not the way you want to do it. You want integrated programs that examines, in particular, the interaction between refugees and host communities. This is something that, coming from Centers for Disease Control, has been a very good learning experience for me at UNHCR. HCR is a protection agency. And HIV and protection is a major issue, and as we know, human rights. There have been numerous violations of refugees when they cross a border, when they seek asylum. Some countries require HIV testing mandatorily, and they don't allow them in. Unfortunately here, which is my big beef right now, is there are 6 countries in the world, including my country, Canada, that test refugees for resettlement. Many of them do allow refugees into the country after they have been mandatorily tested. However, there's often a 6-month gap between when they are tested and when they arrive in Canada or U.S. And during that time, antiretrovirals are not provided. We've had major issues with confidentiality breaks, and women have had to seek time in safe houses. Unfortunately, Australia rejects outright if an HIV person who wishes to be resettled in Australia is HIV positive. They are rejected. The last approach, and this is my last two slides, I'm doing well on time, is the sub-regional approach, which Noe mentioned. early on when we started, working country by country, and we realized very, very quickly you cannot do this. As Noe's experience shows and others, refugees are constantly moving, and if as well as displaced persons, as well as truck drivers, and we need to think across borders. There are numerous examples, but in particular, one I would like to mention is called the Great Lakes Initiative on AIDS, GLIA. It's six countries, and despite three of them or two of them being at war at the time, Congo and Rwanda, or proxy war, we were able to work with these governments to try to develop programs for refugees, surrounding populations, and try to work on what happens when refugees repatriate. How are we going to ensure continuity of services? How are we going to ensure that someone like Noah, who has learned a tremendous amount while he was a refugee, how can we ensure that he is able to take those skills? And as we clearly see, refugees are often said, oh, the refugees are burdens. Refugees are not burdens. They are people with tremendous amount of skills that learn a tremendous amount when they are refugees, and we need to work to ensure that when they return to their home country, they are recognized and can add to their home country. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
We're going to take all the questions at the end, so if you want to remember, you might want to jot down thoughts that you have questions about as they go along, so you remember at the end. And also, I'd point out there are a cluster of posters in the poster session right now, one of which Paul did, on HIV prevalence in various displaced populations. They're all in the sort of PE 0505 to 0510 kind of section there in the poster area, if you've not already seen them. Our next speaker is Dr. Li Natsu. She is from a professor at Mahidol University in Bangkok. She's worked with internally displaced and refugee populations in so many places in the world, it's kind of astounding, all through the Balkans and East Timor and Southeast Asia. She's worked with UNDP. She ran the United Nations Regional Task Force on Mobility and HIV, and I welcome her.
Good afternoon. It's an honor for me to be here and share some of our reflections based on the past decades of work around the world. As Paul elucidated the identifiable refugees, my role here is to amplify the invisible.
Please turn off the music. Thank you.
So, what I'm supposed to tell you is the challenge of counting the invisible and how we define them. They are not the defined refugees. They are all the non-refugees who moves around. Many included some of ourselves here. So what is the number? I don't have the answer. So exactly how are we able to account for the linkages and intersections between the rail, the roads, for the transport, and the air and the sea? For example, in China alone, more than 10 million people within the country moves around. That does not count for those cross-border daily moves because they return home at night. And often, truck drivers are not counted in the movement. Then who are we supposed to account for? There are such a variety of people. On the other hand, some of the people switch their roles. By season, some farmers become laborers in the cities instead of being the rural farmers. By day, some of the factory workers become a sex worker at night. So, how are we able to capture this movement from the continent to continent? For example, for seafarers, according to the International Maritime Organization's registered international sailors, the largest number are from the Philippines, seconded by Indonesia, and pretty much will be caught by Chinese expansion in their maritime industry. However, These are only the ones are registered with certain certification at the international level. It did not account for the domestic sailors, let alone the fishermen. So, do these people have access to prevention, treatment, care, and support? Let's see. Some examples. The minorities. My home is in West Coast, Vancouver, Canada. The First Nations people, many of them attracted by the neon lights of the city, came into Vancouver City. Many of these women, as had shown in the media, just simply disappeared. They are not even counted. No one knows where they disappeared to. And then there's the Roma population I'm working with in the Western Balkans. For the Romas, there is also other factors, because many of them go abroad and work, and when they return to their homes, their cultural practices that made it vulnerable, but they are not even considered. For example, in the Roma family, it's customary to sell their daughters for marriages. Do you count that as slavery, or are they just mere marriages? And then the consequent vulnerability to HIV. We also have the migrants. With the post-conflict boom of construction in the Balkan region, there are labor agreements. For example, the Croatian government has set an agreement, a memorandum of understanding with Russia. They're supplying the construction workers to Russia. Croatia does not have as high a HIV prevalence, but Russia does. And these people do go home on holidays. Then, the issue of trafficked people. How many of them are actually considered voluntary versus involuntary? In China alone, we have people voluntarily seeking out and pay what we call the snake to take them out of the country. The 2003 news in Belgium found the suffocated Chinese, hundreds of them, in the trucks. Those were voluntarily trafficked. Not to say they are the sex workers, men who have sex with men, truckers, they move a lot. And in the Balkans, for instance, in Kosovo, is a no man's land because there's no real government. And the United Nations force and administration cannot administer and set the law for the people. They are only the UN administration. So the border is completely porous. And the Moldova and Bulgarians go over there, do their sex work, and with very quick turnover. Consequently, we have this issue related to the uniformed personnel. But do not forget, not just those refugees included in the internally displaced population as defined by Paul. We have plenty of that from the natural disasters. That is the tsunami in Southeast Asia, and recently the second tsunami in Indonesia. The tsunami from 2004, many of them still are displaced. Plenty of them today still do not have home. And there's less than one-third of them has their home reconstructed. So how do we really measure? We must measure by taking into account the dynamic HIV vulnerability within the entire mobility system. That means if we just do categorization, we actually increase the discrimination, exclusion, and provide just a partial view. So for the access to universal treatment, prevention, we need to err on the side of being inclusive other than exclusive, because we are all vulnerable if we disregard those who are mobile. The systems approach for population movement allows us to account for the source community, the transit and the host communities, and the interactions between those moving and those stationary. And we also accounted for the both domestic ones and the international ones. So, we will need the partnership in order to have the universal access. We mentioned about the rural-urban move for the agriculture. With many of returnees, many of them are young people. So we need to capture the youth, culture, and social welfare sector, of course, the poverty, etc. But also, we don't forget the transport sector, the maritime industry, labor, immigration, and all the others in our planning and financing. The key is, with the health sector, we need to build a partnership with all these other sectors. However, have we included these sectors in all the national and sub-regional consultations for the strategic plans on universal access that's been taking place so far to date? And the roles of these sectors ought not to be in parallel with the existing effort, but they are complementary, so we must ensure what their contribution are the additionalities, not substitution. That requires our ability to provide the early warning signal and have timely responses. The early warning rapid response system we have created by the partnership of the ASEAN countries plus China and Timor-Leste has captured the multi-sectoral signals from the source, transit, and host communities, and they have interpreted implications to make the timely actions by dealing with the root causes and precursors to the risk behaviors, and being proactive instead of reactive. So the warning signals, most of them are outside of the preview of the health sector. That is why the partnership with the non-health sector is critical if we really truly believe in and wanted to commit ourselves to reach universal access. So let's turn the crisis we are facing today around the world, Asia, Africa, America, and turn them into opportunity. That requires us to review the policy and advocate the enabling environment. So we will turn from discrimination to appreciating the migrants' contribution to our economic development and social prosperity. And we need also to target our program, turn from excluding them into their inclusion. We need to have the strategic coordination to ensure the multiple sectors will be included in the planning, in the action, and in the resource allocation. That requires the community participation, which involves the source transit as well the host communities simultaneously. So can we afford to turn a blind eye on the challenges in our people? It is time we deliver. However, as Paul mentioned, I sit as a member, cross-cutting member, for the technical review panel of the Global Fund. Year after year, I've been searching for regional proposals that will address this mobile population. However, in the countries where mobile population has been identified as a marginalized population at risk, their Global Fund proposal excluded them. I asked the government why. It's because they felt they really don't know how to handle these people. So the easy way out is to exclude them. Let's now look at the time for us to deliver. Let's turn the promises into reality and turn our plans into action and turn the crisis into opportunity. Consequently, we will need to... Now we get to that page. Have the good governance, because that's the way for us to build the social capital in order to have the universal access. Good governance can generate these responses that is with multiple sector partnership, that is taking the early action, because we are here to save lives. And with the good governance, we are able to build community resilience for human security. Thank you very much.
perfect. Yet she had about 2 seconds left on the timer. We're going to switch order here because Paul Farmer needs to leave us a little early. What's remarkable about Paul Farmer is that he has a background as both an anthropologist and as a physician. So he brings a very special outlook to the work that he does. I'm sure most people in this audience are familiar with what I'm talking about. He's one of the founders of Partners in Health. He's on the faculty at the Harvard Medical School. And he's probably well known to most of you for 3 major projects in Haiti, in Peru, and now in Rwanda. Paul.
Thank you very much. After Lori's stern admonition to not be anecdotal, which we've heard her make before, I would add, however, that that's why she writes 900-page books with 300 pages of footnotes, because she doesn't want to be anecdotal. And since we have 12 minutes, I'm going to make 2 points and try to ground them in experience in a number of countries riven by violence. The first point has been made already by those who've spoken already. It's not so easy to define what is meant by refugee, by displacement, and notions of mobility and vulnerability are difficult to pin down in straightforward terms. And the second is, that would be the anthropologist speaking. The second point I'll make is going to be about delivering care in settings of violence. And here we go. I just want to start by referring, as Laura just did, to Peru. And some of my colleagues from Peru are here today. And when we started working in Peru, many did not define the population we were serving in the urban slums, or they're called invasions there, as refugees. But there was an argument going on, a rather brisk one, as to whether or not they were displaced by civil war or had been economic refugees. And you'll find the same argument in each of the settings that's been discussed so far. Haiti is actually a very famous example, and I'll return to that in closing. And I want to show this picture just to remind myself that the point I'm going to make as an anthropologist is that our understanding of displacement and vulnerability needs to be geographically broad and also a little bit historically deeper. So the populations we served here through a model which I described in discussing Haiti was largely one in which the people living in these invasions or young settlements, as they're called, almost none of them had been born there. And in fact, this area and many others around Lima and many other cities in Africa and in Latin America have really sprung up over the last 2 decades. And again, I promise, Laurie, it's not an anecdote. Actually, I saw this child on Thursday in Rwanda. And this is not to discuss the genocide in looking at a child. It's not to argue for a historically deep discussion. But this child doesn't have HIV. However, he picked up a landmine on March 22nd. And so he is nowhere counted among the casualties of the 1994 conflict, and won't be. And because this was 11 years later, and yet he is, as are most of the people we're serving in rural Rwanda, about 60% of the people we're serving are held to be returnees, internally displaced persons, or refugees. And to return to the other point about planning and funding programs in these sorts of settings, it's going to require a lot more careful analysis to understand that the brutal upshots of war, genocide, and regional conflicts are often not seen for many years. Again, in this case, 12 years later, when the hostilities in Rwanda are over, there's still a lot that can be incorporated into our planning if we want to do a good job delivering services to people who are not only, in this case, rather dramatically vulnerable to things like picking up landmines, but more prosaically and more importantly, there are people who, again, as in the Peru case, have not been living in this region for very long. As an aside, I'm glad that Paul brought up the controversies, Lori too, about the impact of violence and war on the transmission of HIV. It's a very mixed bag of literature, as was mentioned. And you saw Paul's maps of this region, Rwanda. But we do know some things. For example, among over 1,000 women who were raped during the genocide, one cohort, the largest cohort that I know about, 66% of these women were living with HIV. And that was a figure from 2003. So again, the full weight of violence and in this case genocide really are still to be felt for many. These women, most of them do not have access to HIV care, although in Rwanda they're certainly making a great deal of progress, probably even compared to Burundi. There's a lot going on, and certainly compared to Congo, there's a lot going on to remediate this. But these conflicts don't go away, is my point in speaking about both settings. And I'd like to focus my intervention comments on Haiti. And some of you have seen this image before and will forgive me. I'm actually teased about using this image at Partners in Health. Actually, I'm teased at Partners in Health about using this image. I'm very conscious about being next to a famous writer who's going to correct my grammar later anyway. When I first laid eyes in this place in rural Haiti, this is a hydroelectric dam. The people living there describe themselves as water refugees. And again, that was a completely novel term to me. I'd never heard it before and still haven't seen it very often in print. But the people we served had all been displaced by violence in any conventional sense, although they had a very different take on this, which I'll share with you in a minute, but rather by a development project. And some of you are familiar with other projects like this that have displaced really very substantial populations, although fewer now in the last few years than, say, 15 or 20 years ago. So that was the term they used, water refugees. And it led me to rethink some of my understandings of what the term refugee meant and also what this was many years before the term IDP, or internally displaced persons, was used. So not only did they consider themselves refugees, many of the people we served, but also victims of violence. And again, they had a much more, my host in Haiti had a much richer vocabulary than I did to describe various kinds of violence. Now, since this is not a meeting of the American Anthropological Association, I'm not going to bore you with some of the terms that we came up with trying to describe the sort of violence that was meant by my Haitian hosts. For example, they would say, and you know, again, I'm speaking about not all Haitians, but the ones with whom I work and live now for over 20 years, is racism a form of violence? You know, is gender inequality a form of violence? And although the definitions that we use in the in circles like ours, where policy circles or providing circles, we tend not to think of these as violence. And in fact, broadening the term is frowned upon as weakening our ability to provide, to make strategies, make strategic plans, etc. That, however, is not a view shared in any of the places where I've worked. In Rwanda, which I'm getting to know now, in Peru, and certainly in Haiti, the view of violence was very similar, that the notions are much broader, and that things like losing your land to a hydroelectric dam constituted a form of violence. Now, all of this theoretical debate is interesting, certainly interesting to me. And Haiti is a test case. Some of you remember, I mean, this is actually meant, I'm sure, is very funny by the cartoonists, but from inside Haiti, of course, you know, it feels very different. Our group, Partners in Health, really cut its teeth in settings of displacement and violence. So before we knew it, before we ever went to Peru or Guatemala, other places where violence was really a serious problem, we had learned a lot about getting around, in our service delivery, getting around very substantial logistic and violence-related problems. And by the time this particular coup which was a doozy, happened in 2004. I think you can. These are from a report by the Pan American Health Association about the level of impact of this violence in the health services. And if some people here are from Doctors Without Borders in Haiti, they're actually working in a much more beleaguered area now, which is urban Haiti. But it just so happens that this coup began in central Haiti, right where we were. And so we had, for example, we made contingency plans in the event that medical staff was kidnapped, ambulances were stolen, and stock deliveries were disrupted. All that happened, by the way. And if you're interested, we've written a little bit about getting around this. But my point is that it is very difficult to provide sound public health services in settings of violence. And that's hardly going to come as a shock to any of you. However, I'm not talking about giving treatment to the wounded or making sure blood transfusions occur or that hospitals provide services. Those are difficult enough, as you can see from the PAHO's report. But to deliver HIV services or tuberculosis services or diabetes care, that is to deliver sustained therapy for a chronic illness, is very, very challenging and requires planning. Now, that again has already been said. The one thing that I'd like to add that I think I made a pledge when I decided to come to the Toronto meetings that I was going to focus in every one of the sessions in which I participated a little bit on 2 points, food security, which I've done my bit already, and people here on this panel and those of you in this audience don't need to know about the importance of food security. Everyone who works with refugees and displaced persons knows this, because many of those displaced are, of course, displaced from their means of supplying their family with food. So that's too self-evident to discuss here. The other point, and the one that I'd like to close with, is that when, for example, ambulances are hijacked by rebels, and I think, and my colleagues from Haiti are here, I think that's 4 times, if I'm not mistaken, and or staff, nurses, and physicians are kidnapped, or roads are blocked, or bridges destroyed, again, all of which we've seen, the only way we can hope to provide really sound care for a chronic illness is to make sure that we have a strong community presence. And that may seem difficult in working with refugees, and it is challenging, but we are not a community presence. Just by the fact of our presence here in Toronto, we're not in those communities today. And some of us, like Noé, have deep ties to specific communities, but many of us can move easily between these settings. And so my last image and my last second is the importance of training community health workers to be there when violence and other major political economic disruptions make it difficult to do our work. Thank you very much.
Good news. Dr. Farmer's going to stick around. That's great. So our next speaker is Dr. David Mosca, who is with the International Organization on Migration. He's an emergency surgeon. He's based in Nairobi, and he serves a key liaison function between the IOM and the World Health Organization. Please.
Thank you. I have a difficult task here. It'll be last speaker after so eloquent presentations. Let me start, if you allow me, with a quote from the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who says, "Today real borders are not between nations, but between powerful and powerless, free and fettered, privileged and humiliated. Today, no walls can separate humanitarian or human rights crisis in one part of the world from national security crisis in the other." This quote, I believe, helps us in situating migration, displacement, and human mobility in the complex perspective of a globalized world, interconnected and interrelated, but where inequalities and disparity persist. And human mobility relates to human rights, human and national security, development, and survival. When addressing the issue of mobile population, we usually refer to a framework that describes voluntary, planned, and involuntary, unplanned movements. The question, as has been said by colleagues, is the reality is a very fluid one. Sometimes a person starts his journey as a worker, so motivated by a will, and because of many things that could happen during the journey, because maybe taken by debt, bondage, can find in slavery and maybe become a trafficked person. It's not infrequent to have two people that leave the same country for the same reason and one become a refugee under some level of protection and access to services, another one, because doesn't get that status, become an irregular migrant or fearing persecution from police and expulsion, and maybe find himself or herself in a kind of work that could be a factor of risk to health. So in reality, things are very much fluid, and what is important is really the context in which a person can find oneself. Now, sometimes we forget also that there are people left home, the dependents, the sex partners left behind, and the community at source transit, a destination with whom people will relate. Now, as Lina mentioned, the invisible one, there are those that certainly are of particular concern to us. There are people that are not considered. They are sometimes falling through the cracks of health and social policy and programs. And these are those that are considered irregular. Some people call them illegal. We don't believe there are illegal people. There are irregular people that find themselves in a condition of irregularities. There are trafficked people. There are children, migrant children, street children, soldier children, many others. And certainly all those that are left behind by these people that migrate. The common denominator for these people, the common attribute they have is the low awareness of policymakers and service providers. They are overlooked by international community and donors. They lack substantive data that can help us to understand what they need socially in terms of health arts, and certainly they are particularly difficult to access. Now, what is the global magnitude of the mobility? IOM estimates that 3% of the world population is a migrant, so one person out of 35, and there is a growing feminization of the migration phenomenon, so there are 50% of women. Now, and certainly this will grow, and will grow as far and as long as economic imbalance and conflict exist. And let me say also, and maybe also as long as growing economy will rely on the labor contribution of irregular migrants. Now, the mobility patterns can be pretty much diverse, but certainly they are always motivated by an attempt to improve human security and well-being. It is important, in my opinion, to consider population mobility also in a development and human security perspective, where health is an important underlying factor. The World Bank estimates that in 2005, remittances sent back home by migrants were twice the level of the overall development aid and significantly contributed to sustain households in medium and low-income countries. Now, when one considers the issue of migrants' vulnerability to HIV and the impact on family and household and the communities of the ill health of the breadwinners, the urgency of addressing migrants' specific vulnerability and needs, including access to health services and antiretroviral treatment, is easier understood. Now, when we talk about also the human capital that the mobility represents, and we have mentioned the migrant workers, what about the refugees? What is the human capital, the potential that is in sometimes taken away from the potential contribution that these people can have if they were allowed to contribute? And we have seen how refugee or ex-refugee can contribute to the cause also of the HIV-5. Now, unfortunately, growing migration nowadays and human mobility take place in an era of increasing restrictive immigration policies and increasing discrimination and xenophobic hostility toward migrants and refugees. Now, this greatly hinders social integration and access to services, and further drives irregular and unsafe mobility and unsafe health-seeking behaviors. This translates in a vicious cycle of exclusion and vulnerability with no sound public health justification. Now, what makes mobile population vulnerable? A conceptual framework that tries to describe the complex phenomena that refer to individual and environment. Both conflict-affected and voluntary mobile population go through mobility cycles. In both cases, HIV vulnerability is based upon a context-specific set of individual and structural factors at each stage of the process. And the vulnerability and risk will be different in the phase, something that we have to consider. It might be higher, for example, at the pre-departure phase, when a person might decide to migrate without having documents and maybe rely on a broker or a smuggler, and then because of that find self in a situation slavery or violence or any other forms of abuse, including find self in a sex forced work, or can be during the transit, and we know particularly women are particularly vulnerable in this. Sometimes they have to trade sex for the safe journey to cross the border once they have initiated a journey, or a destination. Imagine the informal workers in farms in remote areas, leaving all men with money and separated from a social support and easy access to alcohol and maybe commercial sex. Now, we try to see what are the determinants, the similarity and difference between forced and voluntary migration. Well, we believe there are more similarities than differences, and probably the differences are the modulation of the different individual and environmental structural factors to various degree they can impact. Now, but certainly the commonalities are separation from cultural and social norms, sometimes the regular sex partner, the native language and culture, the network of social support. They live marginalization, poverty, xenophobia, exploitation, discrimination, and certainly they are hard to reach. And this is particularly relevant to the continuity of care. We have mentioned the importance of find a way to provide antiretroviral treatment and prevention to mobile population. This is something with which we are very much challenged and concerned. We don't know how to do it. We really need to learn how we can do that, because we know that we need to start, but how to continue because of their mobility. There are differences, and again, the differences are determined by the nature of the mobility, the context in which it happens, the legal status that a person has as a migrant, the difference in health and migration policy in a given country and region, the level of protection, and again, sometimes refugees maybe are better protected than internally displaced people or irregular migrants or certainly trafficked persons. Now, the availability of service and the capacity to access it, because the two things might not go together. Now, of course, the health profile and knowledge of the individual, the gender, the visibility and attention of the international community, including donors. Now, what framework we can use for approach? Again, acting on individuals, but trying also to address the issues related to the mobility structure and vulnerability. Probably this is easier because changing behavior, addressing the issue of behavior might be certainly complex, but in any case is related to the structure of the mobility process itself. Indeed, there is a need to change policies from exclusion to inclusion, of improving living and working conditions of migrants, facilitating access for them to care and support, establish multi-sectoral collaboration, particularly also with the private sector. This is relevant in terms of, you know, in the informal labor market and the risk associated with HIV that is associated with that. And finally, empowering migrants and hostel community for doing that. Action should include mainstream mobility into HIV programming and mobilize resources, overcome structural barriers in terms of policy and regulation, programs that reduce vulnerability through the structure of the migration process. We need to improve surveillance system to capture data on the invisible. We need to facilitate collaboration with many stakeholders at regional level and cross-border. And indeed, we need to raise awareness on HIV risk, right and obligation for a safe, informed, and responsible mobility for migrants. Last, we need to facilitate access to treatment. Thank you.
That's pretty spectacular. All our speakers stuck to time, which means that there's plenty of time for your questions. As you're moving up to the microphones, I just want to point out that it's interesting. Our next meeting will be in Mexico City, and I believe that I'm right that the largest migrating population across borders in the world today is Mexican and Central American moving to El Norte. I suspect we'll hear a lot about this 2 years from now when we meet. I have a request to those of you asking questions. This is not an opportunity to give a speech. It would be really nice if you'd get to the question, and please identify yourself. Let's go to microphone number one.
Hi, I'm Tamil Kendall from the Population Council in Mexico City, and I do want to share with the audience that quite a lot of work on HIV, AIDS, and mobility has been done in the Mesoamerican region. It is in the national strategic plans of the majority of the countries, and there are two ongoing sub-regional projects there, one funded by the World Bank and one funded by the Global Fund, so that may be of interest to some of you. The question that I have is a bit what David raised, is could anyone on the panel give specific examples of providing continuous antiretroviral treatment to positive migrants?
Anybody want to take that? Okay, Paul.
Thank you for the question. I will, because of my experience, I'll stick mostly with refugees. And there have now been, this was quite controversial, 4 or 5 years ago, it was felt that refugees shouldn't even have antiretroviral therapy. Now it's the reverse, and I think most people feel that refugees should have. We have specific examples, numerous now, of, in fact, Burundian refugees recently people from Burundi becoming a refugee to Tanzania who are on antiretroviral therapy, and we were able to provide antiretroviral therapy to them continuously to continue their treatment. My favorite example, and I'll give you, and so there are actually hundreds of examples, but they're not systematic. My favorite example, though, are Sudanese refugees crossing the border into DRC, living in a small little place called Aru, crossing the border into Uganda, into Arua, where MSF is giving antiretroviral therapy, and they're able to actually access it through that way. So there are numerous examples, and I'll just finally say in southern Sudan, for instance, we have numerous refugees in Kenya and some in Uganda who are Sudanese refugees, and we're working cross-border with NGOs and the government to try to ensure that they will continuously have their antiretrovirals when they return.
How do you track refugee populations so that you know that, or let's just put it in the terms of the individual, John Jones made it across three borders to get to this MSF clinic. John Jones is looking for a place to live. How does John Jones keep getting continuity with the same exact drug cocktail over as he moves around? Who's tracking that?
John doesn't get the same treatment, unfortunately. I think what happens, and there are issues with, very much issues with confidentiality, and so there have been instances when refugees have been returning to a convoy where you have their name HIV positive. which is wrong, obviously, but there needs to be a way in order to ensure confidentiality when refugees return and others that are crossing, whether they be truck drivers, etc., when they return, that they are notified to the healthcare personnel in order to keep their treatment going. There are some ways to do this, but the other thing that's very important is that most refugees don't wait for structured voluntary repatriation by UNHCR. They go on their own. And when they go on their own, as they should, I guess, that's good. That's their right, and it's probably good. They know when it's safe and when it's not, better than we do. But there it's even more difficult because they have to find the health care again when they're on that side of their own border.
Microphone two.
Thank you. My name is Mike Callahan. I'm an anthropology student here in Canada. My question is directed to the whole panel. I'm glad that you spent so much time discussing what exactly a displaced person or a migrant is. One group that I didn't hear discussed was nomadic or semi-nomadic populations. And I know that in many, many cases around the world, in fact, more often than not, nomads are treated as second-rate, second-class citizens in their own countries. I'm wondering where you see nomadic populations as fitting under the umbrella of displaced or migrant populations.
Who wants to take nomads? Okay, David.
Indeed, nomadic population considered by us amongst the hard-to-reach population, and certainly nomadic people living in cross-border areas are indeed in that category. There is a lot of experience of TB treatment. There is very little yet on HIV prevention, care, and support. But certainly, you are perfectly right. It's a population sometimes forgotten, and we consider them, and we try to do something else.
Can I add something?
Paul.
Yeah, I just want to add something in terms of the pragmatics. As David said, TB is the better studied experience. There are cards that people have at the cross borders, et cetera. You need an organization like GLIA, Greater Lakes Initiative, and then the resources to make it work in Africa, but it could be possible. I just want to say one word about nomadic populations. We offered some advice to the Maasai in Kenya. And of course, you know, again, the distances traveled are not as they were before, but again, training community health workers who themselves are moving with the rest of their brethren and sistren, and making stocking, planning to have stockouts avoided by knowing when these populations can be reached by, for example, in this particular case in the Chiulu Hills area, by a mobile drug distribution unit working specifically with the Maasai. My only point, it's a tiny population, probably only 12,000 population total in this whole vast area, but some people are going to try and work out the pragmatic details, and one hopes that these can be scaled with the help of major international organizations and funders.
Microphone three.
Yeah, my name is Chris Lamar. I'm at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Just a short question, but first a clarification. Australia's migration policy, the policy is not to exclude people that test positive for HIV, but the application of it ends up doing that in most but not all cases. My question is, to what extent does the panel feel that the difficulties faced by mobile populations and the inequities of access just expose the general inadequacies of the health system of the host countries?
Okay, Leela, it's yours.
Thank you for the excellent question. I think this is the situation that precisely reflects the fact we cannot consider only the health sector be responsible for dealing with this issue. And that is precisely where we need immigration, labor, and other sectors to together work with the health sector. By strengthening only health system would not do the job.
Any other comment? Microphone number one.
Okay, slightly related question, I guess. My name is Michelle Reed from George House Trust in Manchester, England. In the absence of universal access to treatments for all, and while the UK is calling for universal access by 2010, how can I make my UK government realise that it's both morally wrong and unsound in terms of economics and public health to send HIV-positive migrants back to countries where no treatments are available. And as a driver to meeting the 2010 target, I wonder what influence can global UN institutions bring to bear on individual host nations to immediately stop enforced deportations of HIV-positive people until at least the 1st of January 2010.
Paul Farmer.
I just want to add just a very short, non-polemic answer. For those of us opposed to involuntary movements of all sorts, I think there's all kinds of activism open. For example, in my country, one of the things that we do is to serve as expert witnesses in deportation hearings. I focus on Haitians with HIV because, you know, I can get away with that using, faux scholarly credentials or whatever. But the point I'm making is that, let me just say that this is in a time in which there's lots of anti-migrant hostility, refugee hostility in my country, we have never lost a case yet when we brought to bear expertise from volunteers.
Paul Spiegel. Just briefly with that, I had a discussion with someone about that very issue today in England. I think, as Paul said, advocacy with experts, but also bringing the topic up, bringing it into the newspapers. We've been trying as well with regard to resettlement in HIV. And I think the fellow from Australia, what my understanding is for resettlement, is Australia has a certain figure of how much healthcare is going to cost. So if it's going to be for kidney dialysis or an HIV-positive patient, that goes over that number, and therefore they do not accept them for resettlement. At least that's my understanding.
Well, let me follow on with this for a second, because one of the phenomena, and I'm sure Paul Farmer is quite familiar with this, that we have in the U.S. is that a lot of people, particularly from Central America and Mexico, know that if their baby is born in the United States, the baby essentially then will have dual citizenship and access to the healthcare systems on both sides of the border. And you see similarly a lot of Haitian women, if they're pregnant, very eager to find a way to come to America. Are there other places in the world where there's a similar phenomenon of essentially anticipating medical needs by trying to have your child born in a country where healthcare is perceived to be of superior quality? Anybody?
Well, I think in some sense, U.S. Situation is quite unique. We actually have the opposite. We have parents who are in the country as resident, but they are from the minority ethnic groups, and the children could not obtain identification, so are completely excluded as non-person. So they have no access to education nor health care.
Okay, Mike 2.
My name is Mubarak Muhammad. I'm from Sexuality Education Resource Center, Manitoba.
Could you please come closer to the mic? We can't hear you.
Okay, my name is Mubarak Muhammad. I'm from Sexuality Education Resource Center, Winnipeg, Manitoba. And I'm also a Sudanese-Canadian, born and brought up in Darfur. And my question to Paul is that, as we aware that there is civil war, or genocide, whatever is going on in Darfur, and most of the IDP people, they'll be around the regions, and they are being displaced, and most of the aid agencies, they are withdrawing themselves from the region as there is no any peace that been reached with the whole groups. And also we are aware that the infection with the HIV is just kept spreading within the regions, and there is no any measure has been taken. So I don't know what's your responsibility as representing the United Nations or the agencies that are dealing with refugees on tackling these issues of the speed of the HIV, even though by the time that they're going to reach any peacemen agreement, we're going to see people that are dying from HIV infections.
I think, Paul, it was directed to you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good and extremely difficult question. I mean, clearly the international community has failed on Darfur and continues to fail on Darfur. And as Lebanon and the other tragedies occurred, even becomes worse, we forget about it. Darfur's not even mentioned in the news anymore. And I would say, I have to be brief, but it's extremely complicated because UNHCR's mandate deals with refugees and within the United Nations. IDPs, internally displaced persons, there is not one UN agency that is officially deals with them. What has happened recently, there's an attempt to deal with this by having a humanitarian reform. And so certain UN agencies are dealing with certain parts. For instance, WHO is the cluster lead for health, UNHCR is for protection and camp management. We, UNHCR, I can speak for HCR, has been working in Western Darfur. We have not been able to, as of numerous NGOs in here, we have not been able to provide proper care, and even within HIV, specifically post-exposure prophylaxis kits, sufficient condoms, sufficient IEC materials, information, education, communication materials, we have not been able to because it's extremely difficult logistically. And as I just read recently, this last 6 months or so, there have been numerous humanitarian workers killed, and the atmosphere there is not sufficient for us to deliver. So we, like other agencies, are unfortunately clearly failing. And if the international community doesn't step in and start providing some stability to this area, I don't know, I don't have a good answer for you.
Microphone number three.
Thank you. Michael O'Dwyer, Department for International Development, DFID, Southeast Asia. I see that Paul Farmer has left. He was building really a bit, I think, on one aspect of his presentation where he was talking about the difficulties of providing prevention, care, treatment, support in situations of conflict. But I wonder if we should be maybe turning that one round and looking at the opportunities that exist for providing healthcare to migrant and displaced populations as an entry point to more meaningful dialogue, to create space and see this as something positive in addressing conflict resolution. I guess turning that into a question for the panel, what more can we be doing around this, and what scope is there for picking up on the public good nature of much of this and using this to address some of the structural problems that David was talking about? Is there more we can, could, should be doing? Thank you.
I think, Lina, you were touching on some of these issues. Perhaps you want to take that.
Thank you for raising this very pertinent challenge. Yes, always try to take the crisis and adversity and turn it around as the opportunity. In fact, that's how we have been dealing with that in Southeast Asia. Taking the crisis and the exclusions and discriminations and trying to build partnerships. And we utilize the migrants and we utilize those displaced people. They form their own organization. We facilitate it. Consequently, through the UN system, I was convening regionally for the Task Force on Mobility and HIV Vulnerability Reduction. We have been able to, due to the position as the UN, supposedly neutral, that brought in the government sitting at the same table with these people. And that is how we are dealing with that. Consequently, we have been able to formulate regional strategies and implementing it with the support from the different government and other donors.
You know, as long as you're raising the UN's role in this, I mean, I think there are many who would argue that the number one thing the UN ought to be doing right now is controlling the oppressive and coercive sexual activities of UN peacekeeping troops. David.
Just an example of how, for example, refugee can be mobilized for the fight against HIV/AIDS. We have had an interesting program with Angolan refugees in camps in Zambia that, you know, because they've been there for many years, they've been exposed to information, education, and building capacity in peer education. And we have assisted their return at the community level in Angola, where they have become the activists at the level of the community. So indeed, as I said before, it's important to capitalize and change a condition of crisis in opportunity, and that approach is one of the examples I can imagine.
Mic number one.
Thank you. My name is David Tu. I work with Médecins Sans Frontières.
Please speak closely to the mic.
My name is David Tu. I work with Médecins Sans Frontières, and it's a question directed to Dr. David Muska. My question, well, I want to thank you for your presentation on the issue around migration and mobility of people in conflict and related areas. My question, I guess, is how big of a driver is conflict in that migration? You mentioned that up to 3% of the population are now migrants, if you like. One of the arguments against providing antiretroviral or comprehensive care in conflict settings is that the populations are very mobile, and therefore it doesn't make sense to provide a chronic long-term service to this population. I'm wondering if you have any statistics to comment on what are the odds of someone who's living in a conflict-affected region that they become mobile. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not sure I captured well your question because of the audio. If the issue is how to provide treatment, you said, in a context of mobility?
No, in a conflict zone. When the population is moving around, like in Congo today.
Well, I guess the question is really to quantify it. How big of a factor is conflict in generating mobility? If you're from a conflict zone, what are the odds that you're going to become displaced? And is it a real argument against providing care to these people? Like, is it a really big driver, or do people for the most part stay still?
I think, to be fair, that question can't be answered as a sweeping, but rather specific to the conflict, specific to the geography and the situation. But the one thing that I think we would agree on, that all the data supports, is that in most conflict situations, your HIV rate doesn't really go up. It may even go down because people hunker down. But what's interesting that we found with the our national security report at the council is that you do see an increase, however, in the range of diversity of HIV strains. You get more strange recombinant forms of HIV, and this is most likely because the soldiers of different sides are frequenting the same minute number of brothels, sex houses, what have you, and you get this sort of mixing vessel effect. That's what we're seeing in Congo. But anybody want to directly address any further on any of that? Let me take question two, if you don't mind. I think that it's hard to answer that in generalized terms. Mic two.
My name is René Chibamba. I'm a former refugee with 14 years of experience as a refugee, currently removed to Canada about 2 years ago. My first question goes to Dr. Paul, because he works with the refugees. I would like to find out, Dr. Paul, at which extent, apart from a few isolated places, you have supplied some information about HIV in the few camps. I would like to know at which extent your program has gone to inform refugees about HIV and AIDS situation. Because to my knowledge, and to do some research which I'm doing on refugees, it seems that some of the refugees have got no knowledge over HIV and AIDS. And my second point or second question is, what could be your encouragement or advice to someone with a support of some OWISHAs who is willing to help some refugees in the camps, disseminating information, helping them in different ways related to HIV and AIDS epidemic? Because in my case, I'm about to start a project with my community in Winnipeg, where I reside now, who have encouraged me to help these refugees who are in need, who want to know more about refugees and about the disease, and if it's possible, we can supply them with whatever
Paul,
they need.
That's to you.
What could be your answer on that?
Okay. Thank you for the question. You can also, if you go onto the website, we do have a 2005 report that lists about 70 refugee camps throughout the world and what we're doing all the way from universal precautions and providing information up until antiretroviral, if we are providing, if we're not. I must say UNHCR is not the one that generally provides. We do more of the coordination and policy setting, and it's the NGOs that do the real work in the ground. Number one. Number two is what we have found through our studies. We've been doing behavioral surveillance surveys amongst refugees and the surrounding communities, and we've even done some now in southern Sudan where we think they will be going back to. And what we've found relatively consistently is that refugees that have longer-term refugees, some have been there for 5 or 10 years, have benefited from the international and national NGOs more than the surrounding communities. So that in general, but again, everything is contextual, refugees appear to have higher HIV knowledge and better practices than surrounding communities compared to where they're going back into, let's say, southern Sudan was this example, but in your situation it may be different. HCR really has only started a concerted effort in HIV in the last 4 years, so we still have a lot more to work. And finally, your last question is, I think the best way if you want to disseminate information, number one is we have a lot of information that we do disseminate, and you can see what we have, but it's through the non-governmental organizations working in the various refugee areas.
Thank you.
Mike, number three.
Okay. My name is Abdul Karim Elgone. I'm from the Health Systems Trust in South Africa. Actually, I'm working on a cross-border project to improve the many STI services for mobile groups. Our main problem that we have found is that the majority of the mobile groups are sort of invisible, because when you go to the data and try to get evidence-based information, we found that they usually cook addresses next to the clinics or cook ID numbers to evade the xenophobia and the user fees at those clinics. How can we do a better way of getting evidence that this is the quality of service that is provided to the mobile groups, because they are not like the refugees who are in a certain place that you can quantify them. They are moving around. How can I get that information?
Okay, Paul.
I'll just say from an epidemiological point of view, it's much more difficult, but there are techniques, in particular with nomadic populations and other, such as snowball techniques and other things, where you try to find out where these groups are and then through them find out where other groups are. It's not as good as a population-based sample, but it's one of the few ways that we have to do it. And there have been some examples amongst nomadic populations where you know the way they are traveling throughout a country, and you go to certain wells or certain oases or certain other things to try to sample them in that way. It can be done, but it needs someone who's done this before, and it's not easy.
Our last question, microphone number one.
Hi, my question is directed to Lena Sue. My name is Alana Yuretsky. I'm from the States. Your presentation really focused on Asia, China, and its surrounding regions and the mobility in and around China. And I think what's special about the mobility in that region is that it's really been caused by economic opportunity, people trying to take advantage of economic opportunity. And these people are very, very mobile and maybe not part of what we would consider a vulnerable population, some of them. They don't think they're vulnerable. And they have perhaps more agency to move around and to also sort of resist information that would keep them from being vulnerable. But nonetheless, these are the people who are creating vulnerabilities and structural vulnerabilities amongst other people who are also migrants. So I'm wondering if there is a desire to try to target people like this, and B, what we can do to target them.
If I understand, your question is they are the mobile population, and then those who are not mobile, and people may not perceive themselves as vulnerable. How do you engage them so that we can work together? That's an excellent question. And that is what precisely in my presentation I mentioned, that we need to tackle the policy, the community together. And when you do only one or the other, it doesn't work. So by using the early warning rapid response system, we had quite a big breakthrough. In fact, we had a government who actually told me a few migrants die, it doesn't matter because we have plenty of people, more will be there. But then with this system, we were able to convert them to be the staunchest advocate for human rights for their migrants in their territory. So it is doable, and I have great belief in humanity. If we just continue to have faith and continue to work, it happens.
All right. As we're closing, I have one very strong request of everybody. You know, the folks in the little blue vests are all volunteers. Nobody's paying them, and they have to clean up every single room between sessions. If you could just grab the trash around you and take it to the trash vesicles as you exit, that would be quite lovely. Thank you.